Okay, I think we're set, and as I said before, Justices Gibbons and Silver in Las Vegas, Justice Stiglitz is in Carson City, so you maybe get some questions from all of us through the course of the case. So so this is case number 78926, Cannon Cochran Management Services versus Figueroa. Mr. Schwartz representing the appellant, Mr. Mills representing the respondent. Mr. Schwartz, you may proceed. Do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, please.
You may do so, and you get a little beep when there's 5 minutes left. So if you can just quit speaking at that time or conclude, then you can reserve the time for the rebuttal. Thank you very much, Mr. Schwartz. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Daniel Schwartz, on behalf of the appellants in this matter. I just want to briefly discuss the underlying proceedings. As the Court is aware from the record, we have an appeals officer decision that indicated that this claim was not compensable. We then, a petition for judicial review was filed to the district court. The district court issued an order reversing the appeals officer, in essence focusing on two items. One is the omission, that's the word actually in the decision, of the fact that the respondent was on the clock at the time of his injury. That is actually mentioned four times in the findings of fact and three times in the conclusions of law of the appeals officer's decision. And also the seat time question, which, again, is mentioned extensively in the appeals officer's decision. I only bring that to your attention because that's the general reason why we're here today. As we've briefed and the Court is aware, we don't give any deference to the district court's decision. So when it comes to that particular issue, I just wanted to give you some focus. This is not necessarily a unique issue, but somewhat of an interesting issue, I guess is the best way to put it. What we have is we have an officer who was told he could leave work early on a particular day. He left work early. He was actually moving from one precinct to another precinct between that day and the following day after coming back from a workers' compensation claim unrelated to this one. He gathered his equipment. He took it with him. He's testified, and there's findings of fact, that he grabbed his radio, although he's not required to grab his radio. You have testimony from two individuals about the radio and the fact that it was his habit to grab it, but was not required. He got on his personal motorcycle. He rode his personal motorcycle for approximately 10 minutes when he was involved in a motor vehicle accident with 5 minutes left on his clock time, his shift time.
Mr. Schwartz, can I ask you in relation to that, could Officer Figueroa have been subject to a recall even to come back into the station even after he left? I know he was discharged for the day when he was going home, but in reading this record, I think there was an issue of whether or not he could be recalled. Is that true, and is that pertinent to the issues in the case in your view?
It is true, Your Honor. There's actually two different kinds of the word recall that Mr. Figueroa was subject to. One was he could have been called back because he was still technically on his shift, but we had testimony and findings of fact that that couldn't have happened in this particular case because for that reason alone, for the fact that he was still on his shift, because he was 10 minutes away and only had 5 minutes left on his shift. There's a different type of recall, and I don't think the department uses the term recall, but there's a different type of recall where any officer is subject to being called in. And the director of risk management testified at the time of the appeals officer hearing that there's actually a process for that. And officers who are just getting off shift end up at the bottom of that line. But every Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department officer is always subject to being called to work in the case of an emergency. And that's what the testimony reflected as well. And it's in the findings of fact and conclusions of law of the appeals officer.
So is that like again, would that be like with the protests or New Year's Eve, something like where there's Route 91? Is that what we're talking about? That type of emergent situation where all officers are subject to recall? Is that what we're talking about?
It would be from the testimony. It would be something like 1 October or a terrorist attack. The protests, I assume we didn't obviously know about them back then. But it wouldn't be something like New Year's Eve because that can be planned. So they may require everyone to work on New Year's Eve, but they're not calling people in an emergent basis on New Year's Eve. They did that on October 1st. I don't know if they did it during the protests. I'm assuming they did. That was 2 years after the hearing in this matter, so we didn't have any testimony on that. So, yes, all officers are subject to being called back in pursuant to a protocol that is laid out by the testimony of the risk manager in this particular proceeding.
Was there any testimony about the radio? Like, just because he brings his radio is different than him being part of being, I guess, on the radio with dispatch. I mean, during their shifts, they're logged in and they're logged out on dispatch. Was there testimony regarding that? I mean, anybody can hold the radio, obviously, going home back and forth, but was there any testimony about him actually being, I suppose, logged in on that radio?
My understanding, Your Honor, from the record is he was not logged in on his police radio and, in fact, was not required to take his police radio home with him. He just chose to do so. There is, again, finding a fact in the appeals officer's decision to that effect. So it appears as though he gathered all of his equipment and took all his equipment with him on the way home. And I would point out to you that in all the cases cited, there's actually a case that talks specifically about the idea of gathering your equipment and going to work versus away from work, and the fact that just having your equipment with you does not bring you within a compensable claim. And we've given you that case in our briefing.
Are you done with Justice Silver's question?
Yes.
Why doesn't this particular officer getting seat time confer a benefit on the employer?
It's a very good question, Your Honor, and it's a factual question, and I believe the appeals officer addressed it. So just so we're clear on the facts, Officer Figueroa drove his motorcycle to work this day. So unless he was planning on getting an Uber, he was driving his motorcycle home that day. There's no question about that. This is not him coming to work. This is him going home from work. We had testimony. It's in the appeals officer's decision that getting on a personal vehicle is completely different than riding a police vehicle from a logistical standpoint, from the actual vehicle itself. So the fact that his supervisor said, go get some seat time, he didn't get on a police vehicle. If he had done that, obviously, we'd be having a completely different discussion. He got on his personal vehicle that he had no choice but to ride home anyway. He drove it to work. And if you look at the factual findings, you will see there's actually another officer who's the witness to the accident who also was told to go home that day and had no reason to get seat time. He was just a normal officer not coming off a workers' compensation claim. He, too, was riding his personal motorcycle, on his way home. So I don't see how the seat time issue would be a benefit to the employer, but at the same time, I believe the appeals officer addressed that in her findings of fact and conclusions of law. It was noted that he was getting seat time, and it was noted by her that, in her opinion, from a factual basis, that did not bring that within the course and scope based on the Nevada cases we have. Most of the cases, and I'm looking at my clock and realizing I'm likely not going to have time to go through each and every case and answer all your questions. I really would rather answer all of your questions. But the cases, the way that I've read them all, boil down to three different types of compensable claims for police officers who are off the job site, for lack of a better way of putting it. Many of them talk about doing an activity that is a deterrent to crime. And that's anywhere from riding in a police vehicle, riding on your own motorcycle with a uniform on, riding on a police motorcycle, to even the case that Mr. Mills cited where the individual was leaving a movie theater in uniform and ran after what he believed to be somebody doing something wrong and tripped and fell and broke his arm. And those were all found to be compensable because every one of those courts said that someone in a police appearance, uniform, vehicle, serves in and of itself as a deterrent, which is an interest of the employer. I would point out to you that the appeals officer made a specific finding of fact that Mr. Figueroa was like every other motorcycle rider that day because there was nothing to identify him as a police officer. So I do not believe this case falls within the, I'm calling it, deterrent standard.
Well, Mr. Schwartz, though, what if he, and I don't want to hijack your time, but what if in the seat time, he went and drove around the neighborhood until his shift was over, and then he drove home? Like, we don't have any testimony that he was going straight home, and this just happened on the way home. Maybe he's driving around getting comfortable back in the saddle after a significant time off and, recovery. Why can't that? He is being paid. He is on the clock. He is working. Why does that not, him kind of driving around on a motorcycle, getting more comfortable again, confer a benefit that we would recognize?
Well, I would have a number of responses to that. Again, him driving his own motorcycle versus him driving a police motorcycle are two totally different factual things, according to the appeals officer. He had already driven his motorcycle to work, his own motorcycle. So it wasn't like they said, go get on your own motorcycle, come in tomorrow on it to get that extra seat time. Number two, we have another officer right behind him who didn't need seat time, according to what we have. And so the assumption is they were both just going along their way home. And number three is I don't believe that that question was specifically asked of Officer Figueroa at the time of the hearing. I guess I need to stop now.
Well, go ahead.
You don't need to stop. You have 5 minutes. Up to you.
You got almost 5 minutes, Mr. Schwartz. So you can
cover
whatever you want in your rebuttal. It'll be okay to do that.
I just wanted to thank you, Your Honor. I just wanted to lay out the other two scenarios from the cases we have. And the other two scenarios are when you're, as I've just indicated to you, the specific police activity with the gentleman who was running after someone and fell, or the case from Mineral County that Mr. Mills cited, where the police officer is the only officer, he's always in uniform, he's always patrolling, and he's always in his police vehicle. And then the third situation we have is the on-call idea. That's where the Tide case, which is the Nevada Supreme Court case that deals with police officers outside of their normal hours, comes into play. Every one of those cases that was cited to you, that police officer had a mandatory means of communication, a beeper, a police radio, a requirement of a police radio. And in fact, one of the cases that was cited from California, they specifically said this is being decided not because this gentleman was on the clock, but rather because he was required to monitor his radio during the time frame that he was going to lunch. So I don't believe that Officer Figueroa's case falls into any one of those. And I would just like to conclude my opening portion by saying I want to be clear that the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department's position is not that no one is ever covered once they leave their station or their location. They are covered under the cases we've just cited to you if they're doing a police activity. And Mr. Mills and I have had cases over the years where people have been taking care of their canine dog at home that is purely their canine dog, and they get hurt. That would be compensable. Every officer who was at 1 October who responded to the crisis, even though they were not working and they were there with their families or their friends, who was injured, was covered. Because the case law is clear, when you turn into that police enforcement activity, California actually has a statute about it, when you turn into that police enforcement activity, you are back on the clock. But that's not our case here. Mr. Figueroa, Officer Figueroa, did not go to chase down a speeder. He was simply riding his motorcycle home. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Mills.
Yes. Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, Justices. May it please the court. Jason Mills on behalf of the respondent, David Figueroa. Before you today, what I see is the appeals officer's decision and order lacked support in the form of substantial evidence making the decision arbitrary and capricious, and thus an abuse of discretion, which is what the district court found. Of course, you do not give deference to the district court, but to the appeals officer's ruling, and I recognize the higher burden of proof that is upon the claimant here because we are dealing with factual issues. That being said, there are two overarching issues that are before you today with regard to this case. First, the improper application by the appeals officer of the three applicable exceptions to the going and coming in rule that apply here today. Second, the improper adoption by the appeals officer of three non-existent facts that the appeals officer relied upon in order to reach its errant conclusion that Teague and Figueroa are legally distinguishable. As to the first issue, the improper application of the three exceptions to the going and coming rule, as this court is well aware, in Nevada, when you're going and coming to and from work, it's generally not compensable under NRS 616C150. There are, of course, exceptions that this court has adopted. First, whether or not the employer exercises significant control over the employee. And two, whether the travel to and from work conferred distinct benefit upon the employer. So that's the first two exceptions found in this Evans versus Southwest Gas case from this court. And the third exception applicable here is the law enforcement exception, where police are effectively on call and may be called into duty by events that take place in their presence. And of course, that is from the Supreme Court on the Teague decision. Now, homing in on the significant control factors as they apply to Officer Figueroa, it is uncontested that he was expressly ordered to go and get practice seat time on his motorcycle, which is of similar design and style to his employer's motorcycle, to prepare for his immediate return to motorcycle duty. He also could not refuse a summon back if the station commander required him to do so. And they further required him to stay close to his phone in case they, in fact, did need him back. The employer's witness even testified that it would subject him to an internal affairs investigation if he indeed so refused to come back if commanded. He also was not allowed, while still on the clock, notwithstanding being released early out, that he could not drink alcohol because he was still on the clock, and this was confirmed by both Officer Figueroa and the employer's witness. When you're on the clock as a Metro officer, early out or not, you cannot drink alcohol, period. Now, the distinct benefits that the employer has received is pretty evident from the standpoint of if they can call back the employee, the employer receives the benefit that if they have staffing issues at the last minute or emergencies, they can call him back and he can't refuse. I'm not talking about big societal issues that we're dealing with now that you're calling him when he's off duty, because technically he's still on the clock, and according to the record, he's still on his on-duty call sign until his shift formally ends, even though he's been released. Further, by commanding him to practice and get seat time, the employer is benefiting from honing that skill set that he's going to return immediately to work in the next shift or two. Also, by remaining unable to drink, the department receives the benefit that obviously if they call them back, the police officer is still sober. Also, the nature of his duties require him to respond to a traffic accident, as the court recognized in Teague, citing the Larson Treatise, and also recognized by the employer's witness, where they indicated that he is required to be a good witness and report any criminal or traffic events that he sees. This now points us over to the third exception, the law enforcement exception. But I think really the issue is how should the law enforcement exception be applied? And I think that's the larger issue of stare decisis principle that this court is probably wanting to hammer down. And my review of the case law seems to be that there's two camps that the law enforcement decision exception is applied to. The case law is effectively saying there's a totality of the circumstances slash all circumstances test, and that's where we see in Colorado and Illinois, which this court looked at when doing the Teague decision. And the other camp is that they must be engaged in actual police duties and law enforcement. But if you look at the majority of the cases from around the country, it appears that they're either adopting the totality of the circumstances, all circumstances, which also include these Evans factors of benefit to the employer and significant control by the employer. And that's true in Rose, the Rose case, the Mineral County case, and the California cases. The only case that really stands for the proposition that a police officer must be engaged in actual police duties, which the appellant is asking you to adopt, is the Georgia case from 2004, the Stevens case, where they're essentially saying you must be engaged in police duties in order to be conferred the law enforcement exception. That is clearly a more conservative approach than the other states, more conservative than the earlier Teague ruling, and when it in fact overruled Teague as it applies right now. And in the 25 years that Teague has been law, neither the Supreme Court of this state nor the Nevada legislature has sought to overturn the Teague ruling, where the Teague ruling essentially relied on totality of circumstances test put forth, or more correctly, the all circumstances test, which are effectively the same thing, by the Illinois court. So that being said, it seems to me that this court should continue to adopt the totality of circumstances test and not move towards solely the engagement of law enforcement duties, because if you think about it, what would that exception actually mean? If you're engaged in law enforcement duties and you're a law enforcement officer, well, then obviously your injury is within the course and scope of employment. So I don't understand how the exception is actually that useful when actually applied, and certainly would overrule existing Nevada case law. Now, turning to the issue of the actual decision itself, the improper decision by the appeals officer that relied upon three non-existent facts to reach the errant conclusion, the first one is the finding that the appeals officer stated that the sheer logistics of the claimant being called back are impossible. Impossible. I submit to you, not only is that not in the record, that is actually an absurdity. Given the nature of the modern communications, whether it's by radio or cell phone, that move at the speed of light, how on God's earth could it be impossible to communicate with the employee and summon him back? Making that finding undermined the actual things that the claimant was doing. By making that errant finding, the appeals officer was essentially allowed to disregard the significant control and the substantial benefits that the employer was receiving. That's why the appeals officer had to make such a finding. Notwithstanding, the employer's witness said that it would be difficult, but it could happen, and the claimant indicated under his direct testimony that it had happened at least five times in the previous 10 years. So clearly it's not impossible to be summoned back. And you would be subject to an internal affairs investigation if he refused the summons back. So I don't understand how the appeals officer invented that particular fact out of thin air and relied upon it. Also, with regard to the officer McMeans that was following the claimant, who was released early, there was a finding that Officer McMeans was not released early from his shift because the claimant was ordered to get seat time. I submit to you, how does the appeals officer know this? Officer McMeans did not testify. The employer's witness did not testify as to why Officer McMeans was released. My client was asked the question why Officer McMeans was released. Over my objection to speculation objection, he answered he had no idea. So how the court was able to glean that Officer McMeans wasn't released because the claimant was getting seat time is entirely unknown. For all we know, he could have been specifically released to actually follow up on what he was doing. But that finding cannot be because it is not in the record. Lastly, the point that the appeals officer made that is factually incorrect and errant and leads to a problem into reaching the decision is that the finding that there was no way that this claimant commute from work in the day in question was any different from his commute on any other day. So why that is the case, there's no testimony from anyone on the record that he is generally or every day released early or generally every day told to go get seat time to practice for his imminent return to the other division, subjecting him to the street risk doctrine by that very command while he's still on the clock and subjecting him to callback. So him being his commute was very different than any other day. Implied in the very nature of go get practice time and engage in practice riding, which is what he was doing. Now, by applying these non-existent facts, the appeals officer was able to then reach its errant conclusion on irrelevant factors. And what I like to refer to as the beating heart of the appeals officer's errant decision is found in Appendix 1, page 84, paragraph 8:17, lines 14 through 25, and basically saying that this is how the appeals officer distinguishes Teague as a compensable claim and distinguishes Figueroa as a non-compensable claim by finding, to begin, the claimant was operating his own personal vehicle at the time of the incident wearing civilian clothes. Claimant would have been indistinguishable from any other civilian motorcycle rider. I asked the court, is that not true of Teague? Was he not undercover? Not on duty, but wearing civilian clothes? Was he not in an unmarked car? Is he not indistinguishable from any other member of the public? Of course he is. So that cannot be a basis to grant compensability.
And wasn't Teague off the clock? Teague was actually off the clock.
Like 2.5 hours. Yes, Your Honor. Yes. And also engaged in drinking beer during those 2.5 hours.
Right.
In any event, the appeals officer further found that although the claimant was carrying his radio and it had been with him, he wasn't required to do it. It was his own personal habit. Therefore, those two things distinguish the Teague's finding of being dispositive of the employer-provided vehicle and the mandatory radio versus not in, in Figueroa. I find that finding baffling, and here's why. Does it matter who owns this personal chattel to communicate upon, or does it matter the communication command that the employer is exerting over the employee? So if they're ordering him to come back and he has no ability to do that, does it really matter that it's his cell phone? If that's the case, then frankly, I don't understand the logic. It just seems it would be very draconian adoption. Lastly, the appeals officer also found at the time of the accident, he was providing no distinct benefit to the employer, was simply driving home as any non-enforcement law officer would. Again, how does that distinguish it from Teague? Was not Teague driving home as any law enforcement officer would? The issue is why I brought up earlier what the law enforcement exception is really about. And what it really is about is the totality of the circumstances, adopting the Evans case with regard to substantial control and significant benefits, as well as whether or not this employee is on the clock. I noticed in the employer's brief that they indicated that being on the clock is immaterial, and as is the decision by the appeals officer. Doesn't matter that he's on the clock. But how can that be if you're a police officer? The Larson Treatise indicates that they are a unique type of employment, and I submit to you that is why. Because when you're on the clock and you're a police officer, you must engage in certain behaviors. In fact, in Teague, this court indicated he was not significantly deviating from a standard of conduct that we expect from police officers. So if he is on duty, he's still on call and on the clock, how is that not relevant? It's unlike Mitchell in that the mere fact that you're on the clock doesn't confer compensability, and with that I agree. But the fact that he's a police officer and on duty, it subjects him to control and command, and also subjects him to the benefits to the employer and for him to respond to law enforcement needs that happen while he remains on the clock. And that is why being on the clock is so critical. That's what the district court homed in on and what the appeals officer failed to do. And with that, I see I've used most of my time. Any other that I have that's remaining, I'm happy to respond to any member of this court may have. Thank you, Your Honors.
Any questions for Mr. Mills from the justices? Okay, hearing none. Mr. Schwartz, you may proceed with your rebuttal.
I do have a question.
Justice Silver has a question.
How do you distinguish Teague in the fact that it's an undercover narcotics detective? He's drinking beer. I mean, how do you distinguish it as far as this case when you have somebody who's told to go get seat time and arguably being a traffic cop out on the road? It's arguable that they may get involved in police activity over somebody like Jack Teague, undercover, way undercover, narcotics detective.
Is that question for
it's for Mr. Schwartz. Like, I'm asking him his distinguishing.
Sorry, I thought you were talking to Mr. Mills. And actually, I wanted to address the Teague case. Teague has a specific holding that says, like the employee in Evans, Teague was driving home in his employer's vehicle and was subject to his employer's control at the time of the accident, period. The police radio and beeper provided a means for Metro to summon Teague at a time of need, and Metro benefited from having one of its undercover officers driving an undercover vehicle. So when drunk. We compare that to our case, right. and the drinking in Teague.
Drunk as a skunk. Teague was drunk.
Apparently they didn't have the evidence. I understand that, Your Honor. I didn't argue Teague, but apparently they didn't have the evidence necessary to show that he was drunk. I didn't argue Teague, so I don't know why that did not become a factor, and I'm not arguing that Officer Figueroa was drinking. As far as I'm concerned, is not the issue with regard to drinking.
It seems that Jack Teague, drunk undercover, could do less force as a police officer than this individual if called to, as far as conferring a benefit to Metro.
I would tend to agree with you that if Jack Teague was drunk, he probably was not very much help to the police department. It appears from reading the case that the Supreme Court in that particular case stressed the fact that he had a police radio and a beeper and was required, by the way, in the actual facts, to have that with him and to monitor at all times. He was in a police vehicle, and they seemed to indicate that being in the police vehicle in and of itself is a benefit to the department. So was he really a good person to be able to respond? I don't think so. However, when you look at that case...
Mr. Schwartz, I have a quick question. If these same exact facts occurred, but it was in the middle of the day, would we be having this conversation if the sergeant's like, hey, man, go get some seat time in the middle of his shift? And he's like, oh, well, it'd be weird for me wearing my uniform on my personal bike, but I'm going to go get seat time. I'm going to change. Would we be having this conversation? Would we be disputing that him going to get seat time did not confer a benefit, or that he was not following an order, or that he was not on the clock?
So you're saying in the middle of the day and he was supposed to come back afterwards?
Yeah, middle of the shift. But the same thing, go get seat time, personal bike, all these same facts. Would we be having this conversation?
I think, Your Honor, that would fall under the case law that we have concerning the individual who went to lunch. And we would have to deal with it on that basis. But I.
So would it be a frolic if his sergeant says go get seat time? That would be a frolic. That'd be like getting lunch.
No, Your Honor, that the case law is actually the Springfield case that we're talking about today. That is what Teague highly relies upon, and that talked about the active monitoring, et cetera, et cetera. So I think there would have to be some other factors, but I don't know how we can basically say in the middle of your shift, you're required to do something, including taking off your uniform, which I don't believe they're allowed to do. I don't know the rules with regard to the middle of shifts. I would argue with regard to the seat time question that every one of these officers is required to pass physical conditioning tests, which many of those activities they do outside of work in order to make sure they're there. And I don't see a case that says that if you decide to do something or if you're told to do something on your way home that is not law enforcement, that somehow that brings this within the gambit of compensability. And my last comment, unless there are any other questions, is the Springfield case, which is what Teague relies upon, has actually been modified in Allenbaugh, which is a more recent Illinois court decision that talks almost identically to what we're talking about today. So I would just ask we consider that as well.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Schwartz. Mr. Mills, excellent arguments as always. We appreciate it very much. Together with the briefs, we will take the case under submission at this time, and we'll be in recess until 11:30 a.m. this morning.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.